Welcome to Season 2 of Adventure Tourism, the podcast where I talk to people in the RPG industry about the adventures they love and why they love them. I never intended for this podcast to have a two-year break, but here we are. This episode was recorded back in 2022 before we took the break, and I wanted to kick off the season with it because it's still a really good listen. So I'm going to kick over to myself and my guest from 2 years ago. Enjoy. I don't do an on-air intro. I do that after. I've actually been stealing from you.
I know. I've noticed.
Yeah. Oh, you've been listening. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
the very first episode, I was like, "Motherfucker, took my line."
Who are you?
I am Joe DeSimone. I don't really know how to define myself or my place in the industry, except to say that for the better part of the past decade, I've worked in and around role-playing games almost exclusively. So I'm a hanger-on who made a business of it.
I sympathize with that. You did what was your Kickstarter? Not Pretty But Wonderful.
Yeah, so that's probably the thing that most people of the modern era would know me of, which I need to get back to. And if you're a backer, I'm sorry that that's kind of flatlined in recent months. But so Not Pretty But Wonderful is currently a video podcast series of interviews much like this, but with less of a focus, which will eventually be transcribed and edited into a digestible form. I say digestible, but the handful that I've just transcribed already, I'm looking at like 5 or 6 volumes of several hundred pages.
Transcription is really hard work.
Yeah, I did one. The first one I did was with Jared Sinclair, who people may or may not know. He did Anti-Sisyphus and a few other things. Jared's a good friend. We spoke for maybe 90 minutes, and it was a 56-page transcription.
Yeah. When I did the first episode of this, I was like, and there'll be a transcription in the show notes, and I immediately regretted having said that and left it in the podcast. But it is what it is. It's good to have, even though it's a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, I think the work that I do most of all, right, this is your whole deal so far has been with designers or people who make things people mm-hmm. can hold and look at. And a lot of my work is around education or archivism, criticism, not things that are, you know, playable. And for that, transcription is really important, but it doesn't make it any less of a headache.
So I know what we are going to talk about, and there's actually no element of surprise because it's in the goddamn title of the episode. But what have you picked for us to talk about?
I have picked T1, The Village of Hamlet by E. Gary Gygax. I figured you'd had a bunch of people talking about fairly recent things, mm-hmm. and I've heard all the episodes so far, and I agree with pretty much all of them. Aaron King's was definitely a very deep cut.
I was so happy with that one.
Yeah, that was great. But I figured that the old school can get a bad rep, and sometimes it's deserved, but every now and then you encounter one of the older modules that shows you why we have the frameworks for good design that we do now.
Yes. When you picked this one, I was really excited because you mentioned Jared. Hopefully Jared's going to come on at some point and talk about B2, and we'll do a Keep episode. And for me, Keep and Homlet are like the two big early adventures.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I think between them, you have kind of the platonic ideal of a fairly traditional adventure, right? And I'll let Jared speak about B2. I've had conversations with him privately at great length, and I'd love to hear that recorded. But yeah, when it comes to what you build into a village, what you build into a dungeon. I think James Malazuski over at Grognardia years ago coined a term that works really well, which is Gygaxian naturalism, right? It's building a world that feels inhabited, not a funhouse. And I think so often when you see adventure design over the years, it's going far back, right? I love Castle Amber, but I think X1 is definitely still something of a funhouse dungeon. It doesn't exist in a world that makes sense. And then I see that lots and lots today, right? I don't want to besmirch a whole group of creators, but I see it a lot in DM's Guild, right? With newer people coming into 5e, doing their first works, and they create railroads. They create little concise stories that make me just want to shout, hey, you want to be a short fiction writer? That's great. Write short fiction. That's not what module design is supposed to be. T1 is the opposite, right? It's a village. It's a living, breathing place.
I think with T1, I think a lot of people who only know modern adventure design would look at this and say, that's not an adventure, that's a setting.
I can see that, but okay, so this is where me as someone who is interested in categories and classifications and stuff, I am of the opinion that the moment you add mechanics, the category of setting guide doesn't exist. Which is a deep cut, and I'll explain. So to me, a setting guide is fundamentally indistinct from a campaign book or a large module. It is not a category of product or book that is wholly unto itself. And the only reason then I should have it as a category is if I can point to something where it is different, right? And in those cases where it is different, they're purely system agnostic. They're purely lore, right? And I think you can create something like that. I would argue that the Dragonlance novels are fundamentally the Dragonlance setting guide.
It's really interesting that you mention Dragonlance, and I'm going to try and remember to come back to this in a bit, because you made the distinction a minute ago between modules and adventures and modern things being on rails. Mm-hmm. And I think that happened when Dragonlance happened.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%.
But we'll try and come back to that if we remember, because we're going to talk about Homlet.
fair. But I'll just ahead of then just say Weiss and Hickman are to blame. So T1 originally comes out in 1979. It's one of the really OG modules in the history of the hobby. I mean, there are a handful that come before it, but not too many. It later gets expanded in 1985 into T1 through 4, the Temple of Elemental Evil. Originally, there was supposed to be a T2. It never happened. Gygax had notes for it, and then he gave them over to Frank Metzner, and that's how we get Temple of Elemental Evil. And then, if you are the kind of person who finds this historical stuff fascinating, T1 through 4 gets added to the A series, then gets added to the GDQ series, which becomes the first super module.
Yeah.
So, Homlet has a through line all the way through the history of the hobby.
It even shows up when Wizards of the Coast started novelizing old modules in the early 2000s.
Yep.
They did Homlet, they did Keep, they did Against the Giants.
And that was also their 25th anniversary Silver AD&D series before 3E came out.
Yes.
Was, Return to Keep on the Borderlands, Return to the Temple of Elemental Evil. Although I think Return to Elemental Evil was actually a 3E book.
Yeah, it was Monty Cook did it right at the dawn of third edition.
It was the one of the returns, because all the other returns were the 25th anniversary Silver AD&D.
In fact, the last TSR box set that I played through was Return to Tomb of Horrors.
Nice.
It's not good.
No. I mean, none of the returns are. It's if you honestly, I think I probably got introduced to Return to the Temple of Elemental Evil years before I ever encountered T1 or T1 through 4. Mm. And bounced off it really hard. It was one of the first times I remember reading a 3E book and going, this is unplayable, right? This is just a giant dungeon slog. I hate this. And it was a solid decade later that I finally actually got introduced to T1. And it changed. I mean, it changed my life, to be entirely frank. I guess that's a component of this show as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. I've got, I keep saying to people, I've got 3 tentpole questions, which are why is this module so good? What was the impact it had on you? And I can't remember what the third one is.
Fair enough. I suppose we can do those in order, although we're already all over the place.
No, it's cool. It's cool.
So I like that framework. Why is it good? All right. So question one, why is it good? It is good for a few reasons. First, every single bit of it contains a seed for an adventure or even a full campaign. It is, I think, the highest mark for me personally of a module that at any point a player can diverge because I have given them a hook that is where they actually want to go, that they never feel the need to get back to the good stuff, that they never feel the pressure to get back onto the story the author has spun. Hamlet succeeds at this better than 99.9% of the extant output of this industry. I'm talking, you know, when people think, oh, what's a really good D66 table or whatever, right? Like, we use random tables a lot in the modern day, I think starting probably with the OSR and kind of it's filtered through to everyone now. But my problem with random tables is often that they don't give you enough, right?
Yeah.
I was having this conversation the other day that for the most part, if you write 20 entries, 3 are going to be good. And you should drop the 17 and you should just make those really rich 3.
Yeah, just write 3 really good sentences and drop the rest of the table.
Every single paragraph in Hamlet from beginning to end is to me that. It is an item on a table. It is, these people buried 73 coins in a tree trunk. Why? That could be a whole... What's the backstory there? Oh, the old man served in the militia. It's a one-line throwaway for a single guy in a town in a building that doesn't particularly matter. But it's mentioned that he doesn't want to talk about anything related to combat. Why? What happened? Was it part of the combat that destroyed the original Temple of Elemental Evil? Was it something else altogether? It is as dense with story seeds as I think a module can be before crossing that line into being unparsable. So that's one. That's the first thing that I will say. Like, if you want to take lessons from T1 or really from any good 1E AD&D module, that's going to be a component of it. Two, it's a living, breathing place, which I brought up before, right? Gygaxian and naturalism. And going back to the whole setting guide, campaign guide, right? Like, I think there's often this perception, and has been for years, that a living, breathing place looks more like Monty Cook's Tolus or something like that, right? Uh-huh. Like a 2,000-page book detailing a single city. And yeah, there's a level of verisimilitude where I guess you could do that. That's not actually necessary, right? What's necessary for a place to feel lived in is the sense that these characters exist independent of their interactions with the PCs.
Yeah.
And that's no mean feat, right? Like, it's one of the hardest things I think really to do, is to give characters who feel real.
Yeah, because you look at a lot of modules, even from this era, and they're full of characters who are encountered always in the middle of doing something. Like, the PCs are constantly just like walking into a room as the people in it are in the middle of doing whatever it is they're doing, almost like they've been waiting to be discovered. Like I often call it, I often call them like diorama dungeons. Like everyone is just kind of placed, waiting to be seen by the PCs, and they aren't living lives that exist outside of the actions of the PCs. And Homlet is not like that at all.
Yeah.
Homlet doesn't care if the PCs ever find it.
No, I mean I think. You know, it's a totally different module, totally different era. But one of the reasons I think that people so loved Deep Carbon Observatory when it first came out was something very simple. It was that it told you what would happen if you didn't interact with the module. The sense that the PC's involvement is not an inciting incident, is not the driving cause of the action, that you are fundamentally coming into a situation already in play, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the things that I learned running weekly games for kids, which was how I really started on a daily basis being involved with analog games, was kids think that what they want is to be the hero. And actually, that gets old very fast. What kids want is to live in a world that they can influence, because that's the thing they're actually lacking in their day-to-day lives. They're lacking the ability to influence the world around them. They don't have to be the hero. They don't have to be the villain. They're very happy to just be a person who has an impact of some sort. And in order for that to be the case, the world can't be purely responsive, right? It's also a thing that we know from old school MMO design. Right? If all you have are quest givers, it becomes really boring really fast. And then you have to introduce something like PvP or something like that. But if you have an organic world, people will inhabit it and do all sorts of things, right? It's the classic players happily being bakers for their entire playthrough in like Ultima Online. Because all they want to do is be a part of the world. I think that is almost more true in analog games than anywhere else. Homlet does that exceptionally.
It's like when people talk about, there's that old standard of like, oh, we played D&D for 6 hours and we spent the whole session wandering around town talking to people, shopping, we never rolled the dice.
Yep.
That's that urge, is to just immerse yourself in the world.
And that is, I think for most people, at least most people listening to this, going to be a better play session than a really, really crunchy 6-hour tactical combat.
Yeah, probably. And if you want that,
go ahead.
Temple of Elemental Evil, because it's got the dungeon.
Yeah, totally, right? Like, keep playing through. You'll get there eventually, but as a thing to situate you in a world that then says, hey, go do what you feel is right. And that provides you hooks for any set of interactions you might think to have with this world. Again, I don't think, there's certainly not a module of this era. And frankly, I don't think there are many modules, period, that get to it as...
Zarkov is good at this kind of module. Stuff like Thousand Dead Babies and Gnomes
for Levnak. Zarkov is one of a handful of people I think is the legitimate heir to like Gygaxian naturalism. I think a lot of them come out of the G+ era.
Yeah, that would make sense.
OSR. A lot of people who go a completely different way also do as well, right? It's not that was a place where only that school of thought came, but I think there was an appreciation for that, right? I think, and I think historically as a response to how far we got away from it in the D20 era.
Yeah. Something I found really interesting about Homlet is that, and it kind of ties in, it has to tie into what we've just been talking about, because otherwise my brain wouldn't have gone there. I think a lot about how we don't have a huge amount of like artifacts of play from early D&D. We don't have a lot of like records of what play actually looked like. And we know that like there was a shift. Whereas like modern D&D is very much like quest-based, like we're going to sit down, we're going to play an adventure, this is your goal. We know that early D&D was very much like, you are people in a world and you are going to make your own fun. Mm-hmm. And I was realizing as I was reading Homlet that actually the artifact of play is in the module itself.
Yeah.
Because Homlet says explicitly, for people who haven't read it, that it was written as a way to introduce new players to the world of Greyhawk without having to know everything about Greyhawk and what had gone before. And there's a sentence in it where Gygax says something like, you know, we played this campaign, and then he says something like, the situation and the surroundings have been altered because of the actual experiences that we had at the table, but we've rolled the clock back, and we're not going to show you what we did. Maybe I'll write about it in Dragon Magazine at some point.
Yep.
Go and figure it out for yourself. And looking at these early modules as an actual artifact of play has really changed the way I read them, I think. Because they're not, although they're printed for publication, especially in 1981 when we're 10 years into D&D, something like that.
Something like that.
You know, if you look at Temple of the Frog, the Blackmore thing, that was very much like, yep, this is a bit from Dave Arneson's world and it's nigh on unusable. And I think it's really interesting that they've managed to do that. You know, there's that evolution where they go from, here is essentially a play report, to here's a play report you can use, I think is really interesting.
And I imagine that down the line, as this show progresses, people are going to get more of that. If anyone ever picks one of Janelle Jacquet's modules,
yeah,
she is of course known for that. I mean, you know, if you really want to see artifacts of play from this period, it's a dry book, but read really anything by Peterson, because he talks about those a lot, right? You know, mm-hmm, the early issues of Dungeoneer, the early issues of Alarms and Excursions, they exist, and we have some really good modules because that's how they were developed. I mean, I would go the next step, which is, I actually think a fundamental shift in module design occurred when we stopped writing up our home games and making them, yeah, tighter, and started writing things that we never played.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Again, I think Dragonlance has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the idea of DM as author introduced a fundamental shift in the entire nature of the hobby. And that has a lot of sources. I don't think there's a way you can, yes, Weiss and Hickman, you're to blame. But also, it happened elsewhere. It happened for other reasons.
Totally did.
But yeah, I that it's explicitly mentioned at the beginning of Homlet. You're right, you know, that the NPCs in this, they were some of the PCs we played.
Yeah.
The way this thing unfolds has to do with the way our players acted. And again, you feel that. It feels lived in, because it's frankly just really, really hard to write human behavior.
Yeah. People will always do things in play that surprise you.
Yeah. And you can feel when that's been written in, right? When you step back and go, wow, I didn't expect that, but it makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that text about we've rolled the clock back, etc., makes its way into Temple of Elemental Evil. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of the second half, when you get to the actual temple, was DM as author versus play report.
Almost exclusively. That's a known thing. So if you're really interested in the evolution of this group of modules, I highly recommend.
I really am.
Yeah.
Genuinely am.
Pick up, so Goodman Games has been doing their original Adventures Reincarnated series.
Yes.
This year they released the Temple of Elemental Evil, two-volume set. It's a big, I mean, it's, you know, 800-900 pages probably total. Uh-huh. But they do some dives into the historical evolution of it. And T1 is a game Gygax ran. The rest of it are notes Gygax wrote that he never had time to finish and then handed off to Frank Menzner.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And then Menzner wrote it up and added his own stuff to it. It is, and that's why it feels so disjointed, right? It's why I didn't pick Temple of Elemental Evil for this episode.
It's not good.
It's not good. It's frankly...
It's a mess.
Yeah, it's a really big step back from T1.
Yeah.
And you see this in a lot of the, like, the later modules in the Lettered series. Right? You know, G1, G2, I think, are spectacular. But by the time you're getting into, like, GDQ, the whole thing... If I started someone on that series...
By the time you get to Vault of the Drow, it's...
No. It's trash, right? It's completely fallen apart, which is, I mean, illustrative of how the hobby developed and yada, yada, yada. But it also means that, and I think this is something that's also carried through, we have a lot of really good low-level modules, and we don't have a lot of really good high-level modules.
And is that, do you think that's a facet of the fact that most play occurs at low level? So we know what low-level play looks like more than we know what mid and high-level play looks like?
It's a weird thing because we know historically high-level play did occur.
Yeah.
Right? So there must have been things that were written as play reports based off of high-level games that people played. I wonder if it's that they're so enmeshed in the backstory that they simply don't transition to the written form.
It's a lot easier to separate something that you played out and publish it for other people when it's level 1 to 3.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's why, you know, Nura took one of my other choices, which was Sailors of the Starless Sea. But, you know, speaking of DCC, a game that I genuinely love and love the work Goodman does, their best modules are their funnels. Not just because funnels are good, but because by the time you're hitting high-level stuff, it's so difficult to write in possibilities for all the optionality that high-level play introduces.
Yeah. Once you hit like the point where you have a fifth level caster who's casting fly on people, it gets hard to write for. And once you get divination magic, you have to start doing stupid things like this location can't be scryed.
I mean, hell, look at Wish, right? Dungeon Magazine had an entire article about the frameworks under which you should allow your players to use Wish. because it's such a crazy game-breaking thing, but in play, that's great, right? If I'm just throwing shit at the wall, Wish is fun. But if I'm writing around what Wish could do, it's a nightmare. I'm going to write 40 pages just to account for various possibilities.
There is a reason I don't like write high-level modules.
Exactly. So back to T1. Back to T1.
Back to T1. This is a fun tangent. Don't worry.
Yeah. No. And I think good historical modules introduce lots of fun tangents because when I'm talking about something recent, I'm just pointing to like what's really cool about it. When I'm talking, and this is I think also why I like the history so much, is that when I'm talking about the older things, I get to see all the ripples that it introduced.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that like. Although we moved away from it, I think a lot of people who don't necessarily know the history as well will have noticed in the past few years that we've come back to a place where railroads are frowned upon and have probably seen a shift from, if they're roughly our age or a little younger, a time when all you got was railroads to now... sandboxes being back in vogue and understanding that that's not a recent advancement, right? That's a cyclical development. I think changes how we perceive ourselves within the hobby, right? We are people caught in cycles of thinking. And when you go back to the very beginning of them, you can kind of see what they look like when they're first taking form. And I think that's another reason why I chose T1 is that beyond it independently just being very good, by seeing the origins of sandboxes and seeing kind of this platonic ideal of what they look like, gives you a really good grounding to develop your own off of it, right? It's so difficult to point a new designer or even an established designer to a broad concept of what good looks like.
Yeah, because it's, as well as being hard to pin down, it's so subjective.
Yeah, but I can say, hey, if this is roughly what you're going for, right? You want paragraphs that are both relevant to the module at hand and adventure seeds unto themselves. Yeah. If you want something that's fairly trad fantasy, but could go elsewhere, that points to just off the edges of the map there being more wondrous things. If you're looking for something that starts people who are new to D&D altogether, that most difficult place where people are really, really hyped to try it, but if you don't do a good job, you might lose them. Something that's tried and true and can really suck that type of person in. Well, here's a framework for what success looks like. It's not what you have to model your thing after one-to-one. But this is a thing that did it, and did it well for years and years and years. And yeah. So maybe take some notes from it, right? I think that's to me, as a teacher, the greatest utility any module can have.
Yeah, and I think, okay, so I don't want to get too much into talking about B2, Keep on the Borderlands, because we're here to talk about Homlet, T1, and, you know, potentially there will be an episode on B2 in the future when we can talk about that in more depth. But I think it's very interesting to look at them side by side, because they both have similar aims. Like you talked about, you're talking about teaching people what D&D looks like, what play looks like, how to play it, how to prep an adventure. And I think it's really interesting to look at them, because Homlet, as we talked about, is almost an artifact of play. It emerges quite organically from games. And with B2, there's a little more artifice for it. You know, it was it didn't emerge from play. It was explicitly designed and written as a teaching module. And I think they make for a very interesting case study, especially as they both, you know, they were released within a couple of months of each other. And I think they both have similar aims, you know, in that they are village-based sandboxes with some weird shit going on, but no explicit goal.
Yeah, and so, you know, what is it? What was Skirple's teaching dungeon?
Tomb of the Serpent Kings.
Tomb of the Serpent Kings, right? I think is a good teaching dungeon, but is too much of a teaching dungeon, right? And I think this is another thing that there's a balance to be struck, right? You can give someone too much of a sandbox, right? I think this is, however much I love the Hydra cooperative stuff, they often fall into too much of a sandbox. I don't know what to do in it. They could also be too railroady. There's not enough interesting things to do outside of the main plot. They could be too handholdy. And I think it's the rare module that really finds the balance, right?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I think that's ultimately why I hold T1 in such high esteem, is not because it does any one thing so much better. And again, I think it does do some things so much better than most modules. But I think it finds a balance between all these different needs that a module needs to fill.
Yeah, it does an interesting thing that I've just realized as you were talking, that a lot of my favorite modules do. So I'm talking like Wet Grandpa, and I'm talking Deep Carbon Observatory, where I read it and my initial response to it is, I don't know how to use this. But it lingers. I said this in the DCO episode with Vi. It's one of those things where I keep coming back to it and being like, and slowly my brain is like, no, this is how you would use this. This is how you would use this. And by the time I actually get it to the table, I almost don't need to look at the module because I've internalized it.
This is why I think Crypts of Indormancy, another one that I could have picked.
It's a fantastic module.
Right, same reason. And again, I think as with so many conventions that have been built up around module design over the years, they're crutches to make up for flaws that people should simply rewrite to make better, right? A railroad is a lack of interesting ancillary things. I think a long series of hooks for why to use a module is a fundamental failing of a module, which can be weird to say, but I think the best modules, as you've said, do have that nature of getting stuck in your mind. I don't know how this is going to come into play, but I'm going to stay up at night. I'm going to lie in bed in the dark, and it's going to be there. And when I'm playing, I'm not going to take out Hamlet, but I'm going to understand when it's right for my players to come across Hamlet.
Yeah.
And it's going to be fine at any time because it's a living, breathing place, right? If it's several sessions into a campaign and they're already level 3 or 4, well, okay, the forces of the Temple of Elemental Evil have already started rebuilding. If they're high level, well, they're resurgent, and now we have to deal with the temple coming back and retaking over the land. Because I know how these things will evolve, because the interplay of them makes sense, I don't need a hook to tell me how to get them there.
Yeah.
And I don't need 20 pages to tell me how to adjust it.
And there's enough going on once they're there that they will find something to do.
Exactly. In the same way that if I were to pick up a person, a living person, and plop them down in a city somewhere, they wouldn't have to be given an itinerary of the interesting things to do. Maybe they might like that.
Although saying that, there's a whole market of rough guides and Lonely Planet guides.
There really is. I mean, there are tour buses and there are all sorts of things, right? There's definitely an appeal to that. But at the end of the day, if I picked you up and placed you down in Midtown Manhattan, it might be disorienting, but you'd figure it out. You'd be able to interact with it in a way that made sense for you.
Yes.
And that's the thing we're trying to simulate, without it becoming overwhelming, right? I think Tolis is the far extension on the other side of this. I don't need 2,000 pages to tell me how to interact with New York. I need 20 pages of highlights. That's it.
So I usually ask people, you know, how has this impacted your work? And I don't know if is that a relevant question for you, given that your work is more on the sort of archival educational side of things than on the creative side of things?
The way it's impacted my work, so it's probably most impacted my work as an educator, because it's given me a very rough and fundamental framework for what I'm trying to impart to students in terms of not only what good adventure design looks like, but also what good GMing looks like, the tools that are important for them to build, what a good play culture looks like, right? If a living place is presented to you, there is both a disincentive to be a murder hobo, and there are legitimate ramifications that don't feel punitive to being a murder hobo. And that's a really big thing for me, dealing with adolescence. If I give you a railroad, you're just going to kill things, and it's going to break the whole thing, and then I'm going to have to come up with some BS excuse for why the town guard comes and locks you up, and it's going to feel fake. It's going to feel contrived. Yeah. But if in the very little that I give you about these people makes them seem real, like they have interpersonal connections, like being a murder hobo has an impact beyond just you getting locked up, it just changes how you play. That's a really good teachable position to be in. From the other side of my work, this was the module that first got me interested in the early history of the space.
Yeah.
Unlike you, I was never an AD&D player when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. My first game was Delta Green when it pretty much first came out as a 5th edition Call of Cthulhu module. I was like 4 years old. Not a game for a 4-year-old. The bulk of my adolescence that I was playing role-playing games was really in New World of Darkness stuff. That was my era more than anything. I obviously knew 3 and 3.5, but people didn't really want to play those. Mostly my interaction with that was like theory crafting on the Wizards forums.
I did a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like the fun that game gave me, not so much play. Yeah.
I had a 2 week long argument with a guy about why trolls don't grow back into two different trolls when you cut them in half on those forums.
That's
and
what
then they
were
closed down when fourth edition got announced.
Yeah. And I lament how much we lost.
Lost so much personal work on those forums because I was a teenager who didn't back shit up.
Just tons of blogs. Just full, like, years of blog material. So I took a break after high school. I come back. I'm into, like, trad stuff. Numenera is the game that gets me back in. I do some kind of post-Forge era PBTA indie time, I think as many of us did in the early 10s.
Because none of us wanted to play 4th edition.
No.
Because we were idiots. 4th edition is great.
4th edition is phenomenal, and I was too much of a child to understand that at the time.
Same.
5e comes out, it never really hooks me, but I kind of find a little bit of the edges of the OSR and get interested. And mostly think, oh, well, this must just be like the better version of the crap that was peddled in the early days of the hobby. Because all I remember was incredibly linear and heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Late days 8 D&D, early days 3. And at some point I was presented with a copy of T1, a digital copy, not a print, by a coworker of mine at Brooklyn Game Lab, which is where I was teaching at the time. And I remember looking at it and going like, huh, this is like retro design? Like what? Like why does it look like this? Like is someone just like doing a callback really hard on the style? And they were like, no, like this is literally from the 70s. And I was like, no, like that's impossible. Like stop fucking with me. No.
Gygax didn't write this.
Yeah, this is like so much better than what I think Gygax would ever write. Like my mental image of Gygax did not fit with this.
Because my first exposure to Gygax was in an early issue of Dragon Magazine. On the letters page with an argument about why women should have lower ability scores.
I think that's what so much of the public perception of him as an individual, but also of the early days of the hobby is, right? The worst aspects of Grognard's. And I was not immune to that, right? I was a child of the internet age. I knew what it looked like to hang out in user-generated like MMOs with old folk. It's not pretty. And that's what I thought Gygax was. And that's what I thought his modules would be. And to be so clearly presented with probably what was at the time the best module I'd ever seen. Right? I mean, it was just around the time that I'd read DCO. I'd read a couple of things. I think probably Fever Swamp.
Yeah.
Like just the beginnings of that era, early Melsonia, things hadn't fully unraveled. The war in proper hadn't begun yet. and it legitimately shocked me to my core. I mean it transformed my life. And on the back of that is really when I started doing archival work and preservation work. Because pretty soon after I realized, okay, so this is what we have left. What have we lost?
Yeah.
And that became kind of the driving question for me.
That's one of the things that I'm really enjoying about doing this podcast, because I'm really, really interested in the history of this hobby and D&D specifically, and especially the history of adventure design. You try and talk about it online and you get grognards who want to play keep for the rest of their life and have an open pass to be racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to talk to those people. I don't want to be anywhere near those people. So it's nice being able to sit down and do this with people who aren't shit.
Yeah, no.
And talk about the history of a hobby that we all share and we all love. And you know, be critical of it when it's needed, but also be like, actually, there is some good shit here.
Totally. And I wade through that swamp more than any sane individual should, right? When people make the choice to go, I'm going to read BX, but I'm going to read it as OSE, and I'm going to read the new OSE modules, and that's going to be my exposure to this style of play. I don't blame them. There's good stuff that's modern, but made by people who are not shit.
Yeah. Stuff like Don Stroud's Isle of the Plangent Mage.
Mm-hmm.
Really good module.
Phenomenal.
Big fan of that module.
You know, I think Diogo's module for OSE, the name of which is escaping me right now.
Is it Hall of the Blood King?
That sounds about
something
right.
Like that.
Is excellent.
That's an interesting one, I think, because I really like it. I've had a few people say to me, they picked it up, they read it, and they've gone, I don't know what the adventure is here. And that's because it's very of this era, mm-hmm. where it's a situation filled with people doing their own things, and the player characters literally crash the party.
Yeah, it's weird to refer to an interdimensional castle of immortal vampires as naturalistic.
But it is.
But it is.
In that sense.
Yeah. And so I think there's... Unless you're playing a game every single day for the next several years and you're doing them all based off of modules, rules as written, you don't have to dig back into this stuff. That's not where your interest lies. But there's good stuff back there, right? For every one of those that I can point a person to, I also want to point someone to Thracia or Dark Tower. You know, if you want an interesting coffee table book, the second edition of the Goodman Games Judges Guild Deluxe Edition recently came out. And if it makes you feel any better, none of the money is going to JG because those people are not good people. That was the condition under which Janelle was willing to do it, and she got it. But it also has, you know, reprints for the very first time of the first six issues of Dungeoneer, which was the first real zine that included modules and things. There's so much good stuff of that era that I want to point people to.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult because often if I give them original copies, right, and you'll discover this if you go and find a copy of T1 for yourself, the text is incredibly small and cramped and the layout is not good.
No, my copy is, it's just saddle stitched. My copy, the pages are yellowing and falling out because of the age. It's got pen in it from when I ran it. It's got pen in it from when my dad ran it before I ever was even born. And this is a very good condition copy of Homework.
Yeah, you could sell that for a good deal of money. So I get it. I do. But as an educator, as someone who's interested in the hobby, not just as a player or a DM, but as what is still 50 years later a nascent art form, right? I came out of a film crit background. That was my original background. And I used to wake up, like this is actually true. This is not hyperbole. I used to wake up with night terrors about the lost films, how many we've lost over the years. Like that's the kind of thing that really messes with me. And we'll never see those. Well, there's just so much that is completely lost. We know they were important films. We know people of the time talked about them as being like beautiful and wonderful performances and incredibly well directed and all these things, and we have no idea what they were. Yeah. And for me, I want us to have that historical arc preserved, both for critics and archivists and historians and people of my ilk, but also for the players and designers of the new generation. Because every time we get to this cycle again and sandbox design comes back in vogue, well, you know why it came back in vogue? Because a handful of people picked up modules like T1 again. And they're the ones who kick it off. And then people who never read T1 and never had to read T1 do it. And we're able to do this because we still have those.
I don't really have anything to add to that.
I know that we're basically in agreement on this point. I'm just, this has become one long monologue.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. Sorry, I like this podcast to be one long monologue with me going, It makes editing it really easy. It's interesting that you mentioned film because one of my other big passions is folk horror. And there's so many old, and not even that old, from like the 60s and 70s, folk horror classics from like the USSR, Czech Republic, etc. that have been thought to be lost for many years, and I just picked up a box set of, I can't remember what it's called now, a box set of folk horror stuff that's got some of those films like restored and published on disc for the first time. And I was so fucking happy when it arrived. I was like, oh my God, I get to actually like see this shit now that I've been hearing about for years. So yeah, it's, I think, preservation and archival stuff, especially of like a medium where the things were published in super limited print runs that were just kind of, well, it's, you know, they were used as they were intended to be used. And so they fell apart. Nobody was preserving this shit in the 70s and 80s.
People weren't even preserving it in the 90s, right? Like, a thing that's really, really nearly impossible to get your hands on now is the Silver Edition Collector's Box Set of AD&D that was released at the 1999 Gen Con by WotC, which has a module in it which is not published anywhere else. And outside of the 500 print run that was done for it, we don't have it.
Yeah.
If you go looking for it, I found a copy of that box for $2,000, right? Like, we are still so small. So many things that become important later are released in such limited quantities, or my personal hobby horse, right? So Golden Cobra, which was an award that is issued for kind of really interesting indie games. If you go to the Golden Cobra website, they list what was submitted. If you go back even to like 2014, most of it points to Dead Links. We just don't have those anymore. And many of those people have fully exited the hobby. So if I were interested in going back and going, hey, what was really interesting in 2014, 2015? Other than a handful of items, the work's just gone. We don't know. And that's less than a decade ago. So what have we lost from so much farther back?
Yeah.
It's I'll say this, and I know it can be an unpopular opinion, although I find it is increasingly becoming a more popular opinion. It's why I'm an avowed pirate. Because I can tell you from very firsthand experience, some of the best archival work done in this hobby is done by pirates.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same in video games. You know, you look at collections of ROMs and things, it's all piracy, it's all technically illegal. But it's also, a lot of it is very important archival work.
Yeah. I mean, hey, don't pirate stuff that just came out, right?
Don't pirate stuff that people are releasing and still charging money for and need to make a living off.
But when a pirate comes across something that the rights have been in limbo for the past 30 years and there's no scan of it and there's no way to access it, and somebody decides to take it apart and put it through a cradle scanner, that's good work.
Yeah. I mean, look at... So I have a complete collection of Dragon magazines in physical. I'm one of the few people who has that. I've even got issue one in a box somewhere.
Honestly crazy.
Wizards of the Coast released a CD-ROM archive of Dragon magazine in the late 90s, which I have. Even that CD-ROM archive is impossible to get hold of for a reasonable amount of money now. All copies of Dragon magazine are impossible to get hold of. I've just seen an issue one go up for something like $1,300 because there are so few of them. Sites like The Trove and An Archive have the full run of Dragon magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody makes money off them anymore. There's no moral issue to pirating a 1978 issue of Dragon magazine, as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, agreed.
Yeah, I'm not going to go and take my issue one of Dragon magazine out of storage and start reading it.
No.
No, I'm not going to touch that fucking thing. I'll get the PDF out, thank you very much.
On a personal note, it's why every year when the Library of Alexandria comes around to various conventions in the U.S., I get honestly a little upset. Because if you look through what they have, there are some things that I know that like they have, and a couple of really valuable collector's items exist, and like the Duke University Archive has, and that's it. And I'm like, you're just letting like a child who's going to like bend the pages, and they're old pages, so they're just gonna break. Like, manhandle this. Like, it physically hurts me.
I occupy this really weird space when it comes to books, because I was a bookseller for years, so I got drowned in advanced reading copies and free copies of books. And so my idea of what a book is worth is completely gone. You know, people get upset when I grab a mass market paperback book and break the spine and put it in my back pocket. Because I'm like, well, books are meant to be read, they're objects to be used. But at the same time, if you touch my collection of Dragon magazines with your naked skin, I will murder you.
No, and I get it. I'm the same way, right? I've never worked in the book trade. I worked for a library in New York that has a really big archive. That's the closest. But I'm the kind of person who will explicitly buy two copies of a book. Because I'm going to beat the hell out of one of those. I'm going to tear that thing to pieces. It's going to be a piece of trash by the time I'm done reading it for the 10th time. But I want to have one that's pristine. Because I've seen so many things that are dearly important to me go out of print.
Yeah.
And not re-enter print for a long time, if ever.
I've been trying to track down. We're so off topic, and that's fine. the movie Hackers... I thought for years that Hackers was based on a book, because when I was a kid, I got a book out of the library, which was the novelization of the movie, right? I watched Hackers again last year, and I was suddenly remembered that this book exists. And so I was like, I want to buy a copy, because I remember really enjoying that book. The only copy you can buy is the German translation. You can't get an English copy of it anymore.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah. And I say this as someone who... not of my own, but through connections I have, can access, you know, the forums that rare book librarians and booksellers have access to, right? That if I really can't find something, I can still go someplace where somebody else might be able to. And even using those, there are things that I just can't find.
Yeah. Like, to make it a bit more relevant, I got into D&D early, but I also got into fighting fantasy because I'm
British.
Fighting fantasy was huge here. And when they released the advanced fighting fantasy game system, it was called Dungeoneer. And they released three books, Dungeoneer, Black Sand, and Alancia. And I had them all. And a couple of years ago, before I got back into doing RPGs, I had to get rid of a load of books. And some of the ones I got rid of were Dungeoneer, Black Sand, and Alancia. Because I hadn't used them I hadn't looked at them for 15 years.
Sure.
The year before, when I started to get back into stuff and I started to get back into fighting fantasy, I'm like, I wish I still had them. So I go to buy them again. Dungeoneer, you can get £20. Black Sand, you can get. Alancia, I have never seen a copy for sale, ever. And I had one in my house and I got rid of it.
Yeah.
And everyone I know who's into fighting fantasy is like, yeah, I would love a copy of Alancia.
It's, you never know. So on the one hand, you never know what's going to be valuable, right? And that's the joke.
And not just in terms of what's going to be worth money, but what's going to be valuable to you.
Yes, totally, right? So on the first, there's the story that everyone's parents have of like, oh man, I had, you know, an Action Comics number one and my mom threw it away, right? Okay, that's millions of dollars you lost out on. Or like, I wish I hadn't beat up the full set of Mox gems that I had when I was a kid. Cool, because I would be rich if I had those in mint condition and could sell them. Then there's the valuable to you, right? For me personally, I was very lucky to be able to find one of the items that was, which was Shadus Magazine number 52, which was Shadus Magazine was just one of many trade magazines from the 90s, but it would publish adventures in it, and the first Delta Green adventure I ever played was in that magazine.
Yeah.
It took me years to find a copy of it, but I finally did. But then there's the stuff that's important in like a holistic sense, right? That's important beyond money and beyond you and your memories. And we lose that stuff. I'm visibly shaking. I know this is going to podcast. There's no video. I'm actually shaking.
Joe is actually shaking on camera right now.
So to bring this all back home, right? T1's all three of those things. T1... in mint condition is a valuable object. T1 is a personally important module. T1's a holistically important artifact. T1 is something that can teach us about all the other things that are getting talked about in this show, right? When I heard Nora's episode about Starless Sea, I was pissed because that was going to be my first choice. I love that module.
It's so good.
There's a reason DCC is my house system now, and largely that is Starless Sea.
Yeah.
But we don't get Starless Sea without things like T1.
Nope.
Like, Joe Goodman doesn't start Goodman Games, doesn't start the DCC line. There's a thing that he's trying to recapture when he stops making 4E products and starts making DCC books, and it's what's established in books like T1. And being able to actually point back to that, having that physical object, even if it's a pirated scan.
Even if it's a PDF you printed off yourself from Lulu.
Exactly, right? That's invaluable for a player, that's invaluable for a DM, that's invaluable for a creator of any stripe. That's why I love this module and ones like it so much.